My t-shirt.
Hi everybody, today Thursday, May 1st, 2025, and our friend Alex Craner is back with us. Welcome back, Alex.
Thank you for having me, Nima. Good to join you again.
Alex, let's talk about what's going on between the United States and Yemen. The United States is talking about that the Navy is talking about the accident that has happened, which somehow led to the loss of a F-18. Yemenis have announced that they have downed F-18 by their attack, their drone attack on the aircraft carrier. And whatever has happened in this sort of conflict, here is what Pete Hegseth said just while they're having the negotiations with Iran. Here is what he posted today on X.
Pete Hegseth sending a very strong warning to Iran over its backing of the Houthi terrorists in Yemen. The defense secretary posting on X, "We see your lethal support to the Houthis. We know exactly what you're doing. You know very well what the U.S. military is capable of, and you were warned. You will pay the consequence at the time and place of our choosing."
And don't you see Donald Trump is coordinating himself with a conflict that he could have avoided?
Well, yes, maybe. But, you know, as I said in one of our previous conversations, you know, I was considering the possibility that he's acting not out of a definitive intention to go to war against Iran for Israel, but that he was simply dodging the bullets from his part of his base, which is the Zionist Jews and the evangelical Christians. And I've been a little bit reinforced in that view by what has been happening to and around Pete Hegseth. Because some days ago, he was among the people who voted against launching an attack on Iran. And we have seen the absolutely hysterical attacks on him for that. And and this wasn't even about whether the administration supports Israel or not. This was about whether the administration will do the dirty work for Israel in Iran and expose itself to a massive risk in probably a future quagmire that the United States military would lose in the Middle East. And still, even a moderate reasoned opinion that it's not a good thing to attack Iran at this time, provoked an absolutely hysterical reaction. I think that this is not just a mild political opposition that they're facing there. This seems to me like a fanatical faction in the U.S. political class, which are very strongly backed by the mainstream media, and you know they are now contriving this whole narrative around Pete Hegseth and support for Israel and hostility towards Iran. And I think that the result is that Pete Hegseth now has to display toughness against Iran. But what you mentioned, you know, the U.S. Navy losing an aircraft, whether the Houthis downed it or whether it was really lost because it rolled off the aircraft carrier while it was making a turn. This is showing you that if the United States is having such a hard time with Houthis in Yemen, what could they expect if they provoke Iran into defending itself to the full of its capability? So I think that what we're experiencing now is again a political struggle that's going on in the United States. On the one side, you have people who want to cut deals, avoid further warfare. And I think that Donald Trump is in that camp. And on the other side, you have these messianic fanatics who, for whatever their reasons are, we know something about this, want this war. And this war could plunge humanity into a nuclear Armageddon. So I think that it's ongoing, but I think that ultimately they're going to have a very, very hard time getting this war, not only because Trump's political faction might prevail for the time being, but also because I believe that in the bowels of the Pentagon and in the US military, there's an awareness that they're not in a good position to fight a war against Iran. And I think that the result is that the US military itself is very reluctant to get enmeshed in something like this. Several months ago, when I forget which aircraft carrier group it was, I think it was Eisenhower, they were sent from the Persian Gulf to the Red Sea. And there, mysteriously, their oiler, their fuel supply vessel ran aground. And so the whole group couldn't be deployed. And that is such a strange event that I have to ask myself, was this done on purpose? And then we also saw a few weeks ago in February, aircraft carrier Harry Truman collided with a commercial vessel in Eastern Mediterranean. Well, okay, it wasn't disabled, but you know, these types of incidents might multiply where the troops themselves sabotage their equipment in order to avoid getting into these wars. I don't know. I'm obviously guessing because nobody will say so out in the open. But they did have to fire the captain of aircraft carrier Harry Truman and replace him.
Yesterday, I talked with Andrei Martyanov about what options do they have, the United States and its army have. Do they have to confront Yemen? Are they going to go underground to fight Yemen? Andrei Martyanov said that would be a disaster for the United States, even worse than what has happened in Afghanistan. Are they going to, if they're going to continue the way that we're witnessing right now, it's probably they're going to hit the aircraft carrier. They're going to sink one, the aircraft carrier that is in the Red Sea. The other option would be, we know that the bunker buster bombs were not effective in Yemen, and they couldn't do anything. Scott Rader suggested that during the first administration of Donald Trump, they have produced a new sort of weapon based on nuclear bombs, and they can hit any sort of infrastructure under the ground. But Andrei Martyanov, by the way, believes that if the United States uses nuclear weapons against Yemen, that would be the end of the United States, as the international community recognizes as one of the greatest power on this planet. How do you see the way, what are the options for Donald Trump? Don't you see that the option with Israel would be much more easier to somehow convince Israel or put pressure on Netanyahu instead of going to war with Iran, with Yemen, with all the countries in the Middle East?
Yes, it would be, obviously. You know, you would have to put pressure on Israel to allow humanitarian aid to be delivered to the Palestinians and to pressure Israel into stopping bombing of them. But for some reason, they're not doing it, and they're taking a much more risky, much more complicated route that could result in all kinds of trouble, essentially to save Benjamin Netanyahu's hide. I mean, it's so surreal that it's really difficult to explain. I you know, I can venture two explanations, which are, you know, which are my own. I'm guessing, but they make more sense to me than what the administration appears to be doing now. One is that they're simply placating, appeasing the pressure from these pro-Israeli fanatical supporters. The other one would be that they are taking advantage of the situation to strike another blow against Europe by cutting off the Red Sea trade route, which is, you know, probably inflicting some limited pain, but, you know, it's kind of consistent in the administration's treatment of the Europeans. For the rest, it makes barely any sense at all. So I find myself wondering, are these people completely stupid, or is there something that is affecting their calculus that we're not aware of, you know, some variable that we're not quite aware of? You know, I wouldn't also take, I also suspect that there may be some level of coordination between the US administration and the Russians and the Chinese, and you know, that's based on so many hours that Trump had Steve Witkoff sit down with President Putin in Russia. I believe that there are other backroom communications going on. Trump himself said that he speaks with Xi Jinping not once, but he said a lot. I speak to him a lot. So, you know, I try to go zoom out to the big picture, and I know that, you know, the Chinese and the Russian agenda is to completely overhaul the security architecture in the region, and it seems to me that a delay, you know, Israel is a real problem in that sense. But Israel might become a much bigger problem if it faces an external attack. So if it goes to a war against Iran, then, you know, you would get the whole Israeli society close ranks behind their leader, whoever, even if they hate him, Benjamin Netanyahu, right? And then it's all out war. And then you can't tell what the consequences might be, medium term and long term. Whereas if you restrain yourself, you see Israel succumbing to its own internal conflicts. And I think that ultimately this is weakening Israel more than external attacks. And you know, now majority of Israelis think that there's going to be a civil war. Well, you know, one way to avert a civil war is to escalate an external one. So in trying to interpret what the Trump administration is doing, and I don't really base this on the rhetoric, because obviously the rhetoric is usually for the domestic audiences, I think that they're trying to be overtly supportive of Israel, but hand them enough rope to hang themselves with. And then, you know, at some point when Benjamin Netanyahu's government falls, which I think is only a matter of time, then, you know, perhaps an internal reform in Israel will be possible. And then, you know, the United States can take a much more meaningful role in this process. Going to war against Iran would be an absolute disaster. Putting troops on the ground in Yemen, well, just remember how well they've done in Afghanistan against the Taliban, and Ansarallah is far, far more powerful than the Taliban. So it would be extremely stupid, and I still have a hard time thinking that Trump administration as a collective are stupid. And even if they were, then, you know, there's a whole command and control structure at the Pentagon and among the US troops that that has a clearer understanding what they would be getting themselves into. So for sure, there will be strong resistance to war.
Alex, do you find that if we assume that the final goal, final objective on the part of the Trump administration would be somehow solving, as you've mentioned, the situation with Israel and the way that they want to deal with the situation in the Middle East, do you see this administration, the Trump administration, united in that sort of goal?
No, I don't. I think that the Trump administration is under very heavy concerted attacks from a number of sides. But I think that the most powerful one is, again, the, you know, the globalist or the vested interests of the Western Empire, the globalists who want to keep the United States as the global policeman, as the enforcement arm of the empire, at all cost. One thing that is very clear to me, and where I'm in no doubt, is that Trump absolutely wants to end this. That he, you know, we had explicit statements from the administration that they are embracing multipolar integrations, that they are, that they consider the post-World War II global order as being adverse to the United States, and that it is used against their enemy as a weapon against the United States. So it's clear that Trump wants to extricate the United States from all this. But you know, the globalist forces are in control of the media. They're in control of the EU, of Great Britain, of all the vassals of the United States, and this is why we also have in other parts of the world, especially Europe, these social tensions where, you know, the populations of Europe are more aligned with what Donald Trump wants to do. That is, they no longer want to be cannon fodder for the empire. And the ruling establishments in Europe are desperately trying to perpetuate the wars, keep them alive, escalate them, and making sure that the United States stays on board. So these are going to be causing strong rifts in the United States. I think that the US economy is fragile, and this could be Trump's Achilles heels. So there's very, very strong headwinds that they're going to be facing, regardless of what happens day to day on the geopolitical plane.
Yeah. We had finally, Donald Trump could achieve a deal between Israel, between the United States and Ukraine, and they have signed a mineral deal. Here is what they have reported on Fox News and the way that they see this deal.
Efforts at production of critical minerals and even hydrocarbons, we will jointly invest, or there will be in the dollars that will invest into the country, and eventually the proceeds will go to helping fund Ukraine's effort to have military assistance, which ultimately is absolutely necessary to deter an eventual Russian reinvasion. And over time, as these new projects yield, honestly, a return, the United States will benefit from those particular financial comebacks. So that's good for us. This is sort of delivers on what Donald Trump said about putting America first. It helps us get paid back for the support that we give the Ukrainians. And it gives us an economic stake in critical minerals that we absolutely need for the military, for batteries here in the United States, and other advanced manufacturing capabilities. So I do agree with the president. I think it's a win-win situation, and it's something he should be proud of, and I think it ultimately helps with deterrence and security in Europe.
Yeah, with deterrence and security in Europe. Alex, look at the deal between the United States and Ukraine. They're not going to pay anything for whatever the United States has paid them so far. and they're going to talk. This deal is about the future and how they're going to participate, or they're going to cooperate with each other. And when you look at the deal, the essence of the deal is the United States is going to continue sending weapons to Ukraine. This is not about Donald Trump, Alex. This is about Ukraine and Russia and the future of the security architecture of Europe. Donald Trump is about just more 4 years in power in the United States, and he's going to be gone and someone else would be in power in the United States. These are huge concerns on the part of Russians and the way that this deal is going to be signed. How do you find it right now? Don't you think that Donald Trump is just making a new front, a new sort of problem for Russia?
I don't really think so. I think that the math of these deals is crystal clear to the Trump administration. And as we've discussed it before, what this gentleman was talking about basically presupposes the United States providing a security guarantee for the Zelensky regime or for another government that's aligned with the West, so that they could, you know, with the American troops and American armaments, protect these deals, the ability of Western interests to plunder and pillage in Ukraine. But the downside risk of that is that the United States is taking on the risk of a nuclear war against Russia. At the same time, Trump, through Witkoff, is discussing other kinds of deals with the Russians. Russia already controls the bulk of the natural resource wealth of Ukraine, which is in Donbas. Donbas before the war accounted for close to 80% of the Ukraine's GDP. It's where most of the gas reserves and coal reserves and other resources are concentrated. Russia already provides security for that. Vladimir Putin has explicitly said that they welcome the United States to join Russia in developing these resources and benefiting from them. So again, it's the choice between two deals. One of the deals is being offered by Russia, and they said it's not just Ukraine's resources. We have about $75 to $90 trillion of resources in Russia proper, which we welcome you to join us in developing. And in that case, you know, American corporations are welcome to come in, and they don't have to go to war. They don't have to place troops and military bases and risk a global war, a World War III against Russia. Whereas what this gentleman was talking about is, again, the Western European deal, which is, pretty much a British three-card Monty, which is offering the United States a bait in the form of some future paybacks that the United States would get, but the cost is providing security guarantee. And I think that for Trump, it's a clear choice. But, you know, politically, this is a very, very difficult for them to sell, to just say one day, okay, we're dumping our European partners and we're going along with Russia, because, you know, we are on the back of 20 years of solid 24/7 demonization of Russia and Vladimir Putin. So people are all, you know, the fact that he wants to back out of Ukraine, people are already screeching appeasement. And Trump and his administration are now under very concerted attacks in the media, not just in Europe, but also in the United States. So it's for him to get from where he is to where he wants to go, it's going to be a lot of dodging bullets, including possibly real lead ones.
Do you find it easy for Donald Trump to control Zelensky after this deal? or because here is what is what came out in the Financial Times, and we know what does it mean when it comes in the Financial Times. It says EU prepares for the US withdrawal from Ukraine talks. They're preparing for everything in Europe. They're doing everything to avoid a Ukrainian settlement. Russia knows that. If you look at Russia, the way that Vladimir Putin, they have changed their policy. They want to talk with Ukraine. They want to talk with the administration in Kiev because they're finding somehow it's going to be difficult for Donald Trump to deal with Zelensky. And it seems that Zelensky is influenced by Europeans much more than Donald Trump. That's why Russia is willing to come in and talk directly with him. How do you see this sort of triangle that is happening right now? And here is what, by the way, what Donald Trump said about the meeting he had in Italy with Zelensky.
What were you and Zelensky talking about when you were nose to nose in the Vatican?
I was telling him that it's a very good thing if we can produce a deal that you sign it. Because Russia is much bigger and much stronger. Russia is just chugging forward. It's a big, strong country. By the way, not nearly as strong as the United States because I rebuilt our military in my first term. They gave a lot of it away in Afghanistan, and Afghanistan is one of the reasons the incompetent, we had an incompetent president, grossly incompetent. He should have never been president. But we had a man that didn't know what the hell he was doing in Afghanistan, showed the stupidity of our leader.
Hates goes the way that.
Yeah, it's very interesting, Nima, because you see, Trump is consistently reluctant to talk about Ukraine. And here, after about 10 seconds, he gave himself a detour into Biden, Afghanistan. I built up the U.S. military, blah, blah, blah. He completely diluted the answer. He never even answered the question. I think, look, I really believe that this whole back and forth about the Ukraine deal, and especially the, you know, the payback through the minerals deal and all that, I think it's trolling. I think that, you see, that Zelensky continuously is dodging the deal with the United States. They were supposed to sign it a few days ago, and then again, there was a last-minute problem, and that they didn't sign it. They can't do it because Zelensky already signed over the bulk of Ukraine's wealth over to the British.
But we have the news that they have signed it, Alex.
When?
Yeah, yesterday or today. Yesterday, I assume. Here is. Let me check it out. It was yesterday.
Alex. Yesterday?
Yeah.
I think I overslept.
Yeah, they have signed the deal. Yeah.
Do we have the details of the deal?
Yeah, 50-50% joint fund for Ukraine's oil, gas, and critical minerals, zero debt repayment for past U.S. military aid, 50% revenue cut from new licenses goes to fund, tax-exempt U.S.-backed 10 years profit lock, and Ukraine keeps full control of state firms, like, I don't know, the two firms that are. That's why I'm talking, that's why I'm saying, Alex, that it is the endless support and sending military aid to Ukraine. The outcome is nothing. There is nothing about the past. They're talking about the future. As you've mentioned, the most of the minerals are located in the Russian-controlled areas. Ukraine doesn't have much to offer to the United States, but the United States wants to stay in Ukraine somehow. It's influence. That's why it's a concern, in my opinion, for Russians, if they assume that would be a problem for them in the future.
Okay, well, you know, this is a new element, and I thought just yesterday I read somewhere that there was a last minute problem why the deal wasn't signed. So it was signed. Okay, so I will make a guess that this is a deal that the Russians will honor if they take over the Ukraine, if they if the next Kiev government is realigned with Russia, that the Russians will honor this deal. Let's see what happens. I think that the key problem in this whole equation is whether the United States has to provide security guarantee and for which government. If it's a Russian aligned government, that it's not necessary, Russia is going to be in control. But if the United States has to provide security for a government that's adversarial to Russia, then that implies risk of war between the United States and Russia. So I could be wrong, but I'm assuming that the Russians said, we're okay with this. If you sign this deal, whoever comes next after Zelensky, we will honor your deal. And I think that maybe this is the part where Trump frequently says, I trust Vladimir Putin. And then, you know, what happens then is the United States gets the deal and doesn't have to take the risk of going to war against Russia and guarantee Kiev's security.
Yeah. And how about the role of Europe? We know in the talk that Macron trying to influence the situation in Ukraine, United Kingdom is trying to do everything. But is the situation, you mentioned the way that Donald Trump is just trying to do everything, but is the situation under the control of Donald Trump? I ask you, why Russia has changed its mind toward Ukraine? Before they were talking about, we are not going to talk with Zelensky and his administration. Yesterday, we've learned Peskov said that the Ukrainian army is not in full control of Kiev. These are huge messages from Russia. Russia is concerned of these sort of details that are much more important for Russia than those ones. And who's Zelensky? Who's behind Zelensky? These are important, but who's running the army in Ukraine? What would be the outcome of this sort of deal between the United States and Ukraine?
Look, it's possible that Russians are playing for time. You know, so the 30-day ceasefire, they rejected. So that's not going to happen. They gave them a 3-day ceasefire. And in the meantime, before and after, they're going to continue taking control of more and more of Ukraine. They are again preparing large military exercises in Belarus. So who knows, they might descend on Kiev. I believe that in Russia has a lot of supporters in Ukraine who are, you know, providing information, who are also ready to step in once the Kiev regime starts to fall. This will take some time, but maybe they made the judgment that it's near enough, that it's the collapse of the Ukraine's regime is close enough that they can start talks. And these talks will, of course, not last 5 minutes. This will drag on for some weeks. And we also saw Donald Trump, I think just yesterday, say that this regime is going to be crushed very, very quickly. So I think that maybe between the Russians and the Americans, there's an understanding that a change in Kiev is imminent. So they can humor Zelensky and send a delegation and have a talk, because it's the administration is really circling the drain by this point.
We've talked about the situation between Pakistan and India, and do you still believe that the situation is related to what's going on between the United States and BRICS, or something isolated to the region? Yuri, what's so important and in somehow suspicious to me is that the defense minister of Pakistan was invited on British media. They were accusing Pakistan of supporting terrorism. And here is what his answer to the British media.
do admit, sir, that Pakistan has had a long history of backing and supporting and training and funding these terrorist organizations.
Well, we have been doing this dirty work for the United States for about 3 decades, you know, and West, including Britain.
So that's your argument, that...
That was a mistake, and we suffered for that. And that is why you are saying this to me. If we had not joined the war against Soviet Union and later on the war after 9/11, Pakistan's track record, you know, was not, you know, an unimpeachable track record.
Defense Minister, I just want to...
Yeah. We were doing the dirty work for the United States and the West, and including Great Britain. Why are they doing this right now to Pakistan? Because they want to join, they want to make some sort of coalition between the United States and India. That's why they have to throw Pakistan under the bus?
Well, you know, Pakistan is supportive of the of China's Belt and Road Initiative, you know, and it's been under attack for this reason for years now with the, you know, with the separatists in Balochistan and so forth. And there's a risk that the North-South portion of the Belt and Road Initiative will be disrupted in this way. And it's important because it's a way into the continent from the Indian Ocean. Also, you know, Pakistan and India are one of the decades-old flashpoints for destabilization of the continent, which has been, you know, India has been designated as a beachhead into the Eurasian continent already since the time of Halford Mackinder, and so I think that as the empires. Ship is sinking in Ukraine, and things aren't looking very good in the Middle East either. So, you know, they start attacking elsewhere. They started attacking Iran directly through, you know, and, you know, terrorism has been one of the major tools of foreign policy of the Western Empire. So we see terror attacks in Iran. We saw terror attack in Kashmir. And so, you know, this is to my mind yet another blow to destabilize the region, to foment wars that will weaken the region, or where the West can step in as savior and creditor and arms salesman, and so forth. It's a very old playbook. It remains to be seen how well it plays out. But you know, the conflict between India and Pakistan now depends on Russia as the peacemaker. To a lesser extent China, because there's also potentially a strained relation between China and India as well. So China has to maybe, you know, not exert pressure, but the Russians have taken action to try to douse this flame. And then there's also SCO, which has a year or two ago explicitly adopted a series of documents that, among other things, foresee formation of mechanisms and troops and military capabilities to combat terrorism and separatism, explicitly named as such, which have been the tools of Western powers to foment instability and wars in the region.
When Donald Trump is talking about China, do you feel that his main objective, if is somehow competing with China, is going to be achieved by the fight that he's, by the situation that he's somehow, let's put it this way, the situation with Yemen is not going the way that Donald Trump wants to be. The talks in Ukraine, as I mentioned, the financial the article in the Financial Times, EU is just pushing its way of the conflict, the way that they see the conflict in Ukraine. And the tariff war is firing back at the United States. I don't know if you saw the polls in the United States about Donald Trump and his administration. Why is there any sort of concern in the people around Donald Trump? We know that Donald Trump is not that much in detail aware of what's going on. But how about the people around him? I talked with Scott Ritter this week. He said that he's not receiving the intelligence he needs to assess. Is that going to create a big problem for his administration, or you see he's somehow not prepared to receive them, or he's not asking for the intelligence?
I can't imagine that he's not asking for the intelligence. You know, that would be the most natural thing to do, to call his advisors and say what exactly is going on here. But it does seem that he's being sabotaged in this sense. And, you know, yesterday I watched a program on Jimmy Dore where he shows how, you know, Donald Trump was giving an interview to the American media and he got completely flat-footed on answer on some court case regarding deportation of an immigrant. And the Supreme Court ruled 9-0 against the administration. And then there's a video footage of his advisor Steve Miller in front of the journalist, in front of the rest of his advisors, saying exactly the opposite, that the court ruled 9-0 in the administration's favor. So that's what Donald Trump thought. So, you know, I wonder what the situation is when it comes to Ukraine. Okay, there, you know, there's Steve Witkoff, which is a person who obviously has Donald Trump's trust. So maybe there he's well informed. But when it comes to the Middle East, to Israel, to Iran, to Yemen, I think there's a good chance that he's being fed disinformation, distortions. And so he can't make a sensible decision on these things. Now, I think that is a problem, and the problem is resulting in Trump's administration losing credibility. That happened. That really did happen. And many people now regard them as loose cannons, you know, as and you see the media, they're perpetuating now always. It's an order goes out, and then all of the anchors, all of the journalists, all of these politicians like, you know, Chuck Schumer and the like, they have been starting talking that Donald Trump is fomenting chaos, that the administration is in a chaos, that they're creating chaos. And so the attack is, you know, on the one hand, he's being sabotaged with bad information, and then the media jump on it and make sure to amplify it, and as a result they're losing credibility in the eyes of not only the American people but also as their partners and counterparts around the world. You know, I would say nevertheless that the fact that Trump picked up the phone and spoke with Vladimir Putin, the fact that In follow-up with this, we got Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov addressed the American audiences directly for a 45-minute interview, are extremely important developments, which, you know, until Trump were next to impossible. Literally since Vladimir Putin came to power, it's been non-stop demonization and practically complete shattering of diplomatic relations between the two powers.
Imagine having Lavrov on CBS to have an interview.
Yeah, I know. It's unthinkable. And, you know, I'm as disappointed about certain things that Trump has done as anybody. You know, bombing of Yemen, the fact that Gaza is being bombed again, that people there are being starved deliberately, collectively. This is almost unbearable. But I would wager that if Kamala Harris won the presidency and was in the White House today, that the U.S. administration would probably resemble Starmer administration in the U.K., that you would have people being arrested for wearing the wrong T-shirt or for singing Kung Fu Fighting or for praying silently on the street. So I think that we have to acknowledge that for all his flaws, Trump is trying to do certain things right, and one of them happens to be maybe the most consequential for peace in the world, and that is U.S. relationship with Russia.
With the case of Iran, Alex, we've been Russia supporting Iran. The Chinese foreign minister yesterday said that they're gonna support Iran's sovereignty and Iran's right to have nuclear program. On the other hand, Netanyahu is putting pressure on Donald Trump and his administration. He wants to just destroy everything related to the nuclear program of Iran. And Witkoff is the key here. Do you feel that from what we've seen so far in Ukraine, with the case of Ukraine, do you feel that Witkoff would prevail over the Israeli lobby in the United States? We know that he was, after the first and the second talks between the United States and Iran, he was somehow changing his rhetoric. Then he came and it seems that the latest talk between the two parties was positive. That's why the technical teams are communicating with each other. But how do you find it still difficult to reach a deal? We know that both parties want a deal as soon as possible. Can we get it sooner than the deal with Ukraine, or it's going to be much more difficult? You've mentioned the situation with Hexa, that this is related to what's going on between Iran and the United States. It's not out of nowhere, out of the blue.
I expect that it will be difficult. You know, not because it should be difficult for Trump to find a deal with the Iranians that is mutually acceptable. Even if the Iranians say, okay, we're going to suspend the uranium enrichment and we're going to, allow inspections, and the Russians were going to do enrichment for us and ensure that it cannot be weaponized and so on and so forth. But because it will be a difficult sell domestically, exactly because you have these hysterical fanatics who desperately want the United States to go to war against Iran, cost it what it may. And you know, they don't think of it as going to war against Iran. They think it's going to be easy, that it's going to be just a matter of dropping bombs, and then, you know, there's going to be a regime change, and then they're going to bring the Shah, and everybody's going to live happily ever after, you know. But that's very, very unlikely to happen. And I think that if I understand that, probably a lot of people in the administration understand that as well. So again, you know, it's much better to cut a satisfactory deal. I think that the United States has wanted to maybe get in and participate in Iran's oil industry and build nuclear reactors for Iran, which are, you know, not the greatest deal for Iranians, because U.S. nuclear technology is now uncompetitive. It costs about five times what the Chinese nuclear technology costs, but it's still a lot cheaper than going to war. So, you know, the Iranians could agree to some of that, and they could shake hands, sign the paperwork, and everybody's happy. The problem is in the United States. It's a political problem at home.
Alex, we had the CEO of NVIDIA visiting China, And
I'm sorry, Nima, CEO of who?
NVIDIA, yeah.
Right.
He was visiting China and he was asked about how advanced is China, and here is what he answered.
Behind do you think China is?
China is not behind. Anybody
are they ahead
who's,
of you?
China's right behind us. I mean, we're very, very close. But remember, this is a long term. This is an infinite race. There's no, you know, in the world of life, there's no those, you know, there's no 2 minute, you know, end of the quarter. There's no such thing. And so we're going to compete for a long time. And just remember that this is a country with great will, and they have great technical capabilities. 50% of the world's AI researchers are Chinese, and so this is an industry that we will have to compete for.
This is the main battlefield, Alex.
Well, I think Nima, this is one of the main battlefields for sure. But you see, it's not only just about the AI and the algorithms and the whole magic that happens when you ask a question and then up pops the answer. It's also about generating sufficient electricity and having the infrastructure to accommodate all that. And the Chinese approach is kind of a state-directed approach. They put a lot of thought into it. They publish their five-year plans. And they think it through very carefully, whereas in the United States, it's mostly driven by private capital, which is not focused on five-year plans or maybe 20-year, 30-year plans like the Chinese. They're focused on quarterly earnings reports. And so, you know, you can create the best AI in the world, but if you're drawing too much power from the network and the government hasn't built up sufficient infrastructure and power generating capacity, and the private sector hasn't either, then what do you do? Do companies like Google and NVIDIA have to start building their own nuclear power plants? Because that's what's being talked about as well. At some point, it becomes a little bit inefficient, you know? So I think that China has a certain advantage in this respect. And I think it's not lost on these companies. And so why is he in China? Maybe because at some point it'll make sense to put some of their technology development in China and domesticate it there.
Do they feel that they're separated from China, or because he was talking about competing with China, but how?
Well, yes, you know, there's a, but that doesn't have to be an adversarial process. You know, it could be competitive against China in the same way that Chinese companies are competing between each other. You know, it doesn't have to be we need to bomb you in order to prevail in this competition. You know, the United States in terms of technology and AI is still the world leader, or, you know, if there's nobody more advanced, you know, maybe China is very, very close, and maybe China will overtake them. But this is not the case at the moment. So United States has very good predispositions to participate in this competition. But again, it's a multifaceted process. It's not just here we constructed a chip, or here we wrote a good algorithm. There's a whole background to it: the infrastructure, the power, the new power generating technologies. The Chinese just had breakthroughs with thorium nuclear power, which now, you know, if it's as successful and effective as it appears to be in the near future, it could power a whole new quantum leap of technological progress for humanity. And it's made possible that way because that there is that thought through central planning, where all the components are being put together in place, and the government subsidizes investment into all these sectors of the economy. And in the United States, it's all still, you know, dependent on private capital, which is looking at near-term returns. And then, you know, something that requires massive investments that will maybe be paid off in 20, 30 years, then these things, as a rule, are remain underfunded. And then you're in a weaker position to compete with those developments that depend on, you know, whole of society, kind of almost whole of economy investment.
You've mentioned the importance of energy and infrastructure. And how about the situation in Europe right now? We had the case of Spain, Portugal. It's a warning for Europe.
Yes, it's a bit of a mystery. I've read some explanation. I don't know if they're true, but you know, I my only comment with respect to Europe would be that they've invested hundreds of billions of dollars into renewable power sources, including solar, and now their next idea is like, hey, let's dim the sun. The inmates have taken over the asylum. Europe is placing itself to become the world's tourist resort and a museum. And I think that our competitive industry will be, you know, bartenders, waiters, and chefs catering the tourists. I don't see, you know, other than these trillions of euros that they now plan to invest into military industries, I don't see where Europe is excelling at all.
The tragedy is with the case of Germany. They're not talking about their industry, but talking about their military and the future of their military.
Yes, and they're pushing very hard on that. They're pushing very, very hard.
If they go in that direction, that would be the end, Alex. That would be because Germany is so important for Europe.
Yes, well, that is that is pushing us into World War III, you know. And then what do you get? You get a devastated continent with a devastated economy. You know, we're back to 1917, back to 1945. But, you know, the ruling establishment, this is what they're dead set on. And, you know, now it looks like in Romania, they may end up losing after all. And I think that we're going to see more and more pressures for Europe to simply disintegrate and go the way of Soviet Union.
Yeah. Just to wrap up this session, Alex, do you feel that Europe is making the situation the way that it's going to be so much difficult to get back and make some sort of functional relationship with Russia?
I think that this will be a process that will evolve slowly on a bilateral basis, you know, relationship between Russia and Poland, Russia and Ukraine, Russia and Romania, Russia, France, Russia, Germany, and there's going to have to be a political change, you know. Russia might have good relationship with Germany once more after AfD takes over the government. When that's going to happen, I don't know. They might even ban AfD. They've been desperate to ban AfD for a long time. In France, maybe when Marine Le Pen comes to power, which again, we don't know if that might happen and when, but I think that as the European Union is structured now, it's, you know, the power structure there is entrenched. It's not going to be dislodged democratically. This is impossible. The whole thing is structured so that it's immune to democratic will of the people. So that's not going to happen. I think what's going to happen instead is that you're going to have a disintegration of the European Union, probably NATO as well, and then individual nations restoring their relations with Russia on a bilateral basis.
Yeah, that would definitely need a leadership change in Europe. And
without a doubt, without a doubt.
Thank you so much, Alex, for being with us today. Great pleasure.
Thank you for having me, Nima, and until the next time.
Yeah, see you next week.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.